Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning in to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Chicago is bustling in advance of the dedication and official opening of the Obama Presidential Center later this week. Among the headliners for tomorrow's ceremony, Stevie Wonder and Bruce Springsteen. Come along as we continue our look at the center offerings with Hawaii Ties as we head to a quiet corner, the library. We look up toward the heavens. Did you see the fabulous crescent moon last night? On Hawaii Skies, we showcase a rare overlap of the moon and Venus. We take a walk along the beach and peer into our tide pools. What marvelous creatures are hiding there? On this week's Mono Minute, we meet a cheerful bird from the Valley Isle with a bright cheeping call. And in a nod to Juneteenth, we revisit an album up for a Nahoku Award. It honors the contributions of African Americans here in Hawaii. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Tomorrow kicks off festivities in Chicago as the city formally dedicates the Obama Presidential Center ahead of the public opening on Friday on the Juneteenth holiday. We continue to bring you stories about the center's Hawaii ties. Take a listen to President Obama.
I first came to Chicago in my early 20s. Inspired by civil rights workers like John Lewis, I was trying to figure out who I was. Searching for a purpose in my life. As a community organizer, I spent time in neighborhoods all across the city, where I learned that everybody's got a story to tell.
Everybody's got a story to tell. HPR was fortunate to get a sneak peek at the Presidential Center earlier this month. Former President Barack Obama is said to be the first digital president, and that means his presidential papers have been digitized and don't have to be stored on site in a presidential library as had been the practice in the past. But the Chicago Center does include a library. It's a branch of Chicago's public library and has a portal to access the president's papers. The Obama Library Branch includes the President's Reading Room, which is home to titles in his personal collection. The books may give a hint to what moves him. He appreciates architecture. We poked around and found a book about architect Vladimir Osipov, Hawaii Modernism. We're told that when he gave a keynote at a meeting of the American Institute of Architects in Chicago, Obama was asked about favorite buildings, and he mentioned, ready for this, the Lillestrand House here on Oahu. And yes, Vladimir Osipov got a shout out. Perhaps that interest in modernism played into the final design of the Obama high-rise. It's said to be a modern take on hands protecting a light. The obelisk, or Obamalisk, as some call it, is contemporary modernism with a touch of brutalism. So, the structure adds to Chicago's deep skyline. But let's get back to the library. We wondered about other books with Hawaii ties. The Obama Foundation underscores that this center is all about connections. We struck up a conversation with the head of the Chicago library system, and we were delighted to learn that Commissioner Chris Brown has a connection to Hawaii and is excited to see where the threads will take us.
I'm the Chicago Public Library Commissioner, and so I get to oversee library service for the whole city, including our new 82nd branch of the Chicago Public Library, the Obama branch.
And so tell us about the connection you have with Hawaii.
My great-grandmother, when she came over from the Philippines, she had a stopover in Hawaii, and she worked at the Dole Farms. And then she became a farm worker in Stockton, California. A lot of my Filipino side of my family were migrant farm workers in Stockton. So have that familial connection to Hawaii. Yeah.
And so talk about the connection that you felt when you saw, you know, Barack Obama's connection to Hawaii and his diverse background.
Yeah. I think so much of what our libraries do is they are inclusive of stories, histories, narratives of all backgrounds, all voices, conflicting opinions, tensions within our stories, but they're all housed in one place. And getting to see a president who had that multi-ethnic background, also, you know, myself, you know, my mom's Filipino, my dad is Jewish, but I was also raised by a Irish Catholic stepdad. And so there's a lot about this campus and the library that I feel is inclusive of many identities, many people, and I can see how the world's going to visit this space and feel a sense of inspiration and belonging and reflection on how we shape our communities and where we live and how we bring change home.
And you shared a little bit of a story about how when you came here to Chicago in your 20s, like Barack Obama did, right? You applied for a job at the state library system, but didn't get it?
Yeah, I do have a Chicago early 20s story where I, you know, was visiting friends in my early 20s, and I wanted to be in libraries. I love stories. I love narrative around identity, and I applied to put books on the shelf. Never got an interview. They did eventually send me a letter to say we want to call you in to talk, but I had already moved back to California. It was like a year and a half later, and so when the mayor of Chicago asked me to come in and interview to be Chicago Public Library Commissioner and run the city library, I thought, I can't go run the library system where I couldn't put books on the shelf. But fate has a way of bringing this all together. And so now I get to kind of be back and have the honor and privilege of serving Chicago.
And so this library, as part of this presidential center, is not really a president's library in the traditional sense of it. I mean, this is our first digital president, right? And so that will kind of play into what folks have access to down the road.
Yeah, and I think it's incredible that this is the first public library on a presidential campus. And when they were thinking about what kind of library to have, understanding that those archives are available online, and realizing that there was an opportunity to invest in local neighborhood and get and seeing them build and invest in a neighborhood Chicago Public Library, I think is indicative of them wanting to invest in neighborhood and give back to the community. And I think what's incredibly special about this library, as we were envisioning it, we were thinking about the library of the present today. What do we want the library of the future to be? And we want the future and the present to be more about human connection. And so a lot of what we do in this space is bringing in community partners, bringing in the Art Institute of Chicago for art making activities, bringing in Story Studio Chicago so people can start their authorship journey. It's really about a place of bringing people together. And I think that's a special take on a library.
Well, because of this Hawaii connection that your family has to Hawaii and that Barack Obama has to Hawaii, it just makes sense for Chicago to do something with the Hawaii State Library system.
Yeah, and I know we saw one of the books in his presidential reading room.
Yes, Gavin Dawes, The Shoal of Time. Yeah. Absolutely. I'm just delighted that that book was in there.
Yeah, but I think we'll find more opportunities to program around that background and those stories. Yeah, this is just the start. We're going to continue to explore.
Okay. Well, I did see Jennifer Doudna's book about, you know, CRISPR. You know, she won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, mm-hmm. and she grew up in Hilo. And so just wonderful island connects in a presidential center. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I love that. And then we're going to have to explore more. You know, how do we think about the global audience that's going to be here? There's going to be people coming from all around the world, and we want them to feel a sense of connection to this center and their stories. One thing that we are featuring in this site is the Libby app in libraries. You may have it yourself.
Yes, I listened to the audio book of President Obama's first book, and so that was a delight to hear it. in his own voice about growing up in Hawaii.
Yeah, and so in partnership with Libby, visitors are going to be able to come in and QR code and get access to a whole collection that is pulling from books in the presidential reading room, picture books for kids from multi, you know, backgrounds, and they'll be able to check those out on their device without even having a library card. So we'll have something for all of our visitors.
All right. Well, Commissioner Brown, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
That was Chris Brown, Library Commissioner for the City of Chicago, who we talked to earlier this month about being the first public library branch at a presidential center.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
Tune in to HPR2 on Sunday at 3 p.m. to hear the internationally acclaimed vocal ensemble Apollo 5 at the Cathedral of St. Andrew in downtown Honolulu. We'll hear iconic works by Alec Roth, Orlando Di Lasso, William Byrd, and Benjamin Britten, as well as modern favorites including Summertime by George Gershwin and Fly Me to the Moon by Bart Howard. That's Sunday at 3 p.m. on HPR2.
Support for HPR comes from the State Office of Elections, reminding eligible residents to register, confirm, or update mailing addresses for the August 8th primary election. More at elections.hawaii.gov.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's quiz, do you smell something? We're taking a look at the plants that give Hawaii its unique scent. Some native flowers have a nice aroma, like the white hibiscus that grows on Oahu and Molokai. These flowers grow on shrubs and small trees and produce fragrant organic compounds that attract pollinators. But for today's quiz, we want to know about a native plant that sort of stinks. Our mystery plant grows as a small tree with clusters of fragrant white flowers. Some say it can be smelled from 200 feet away. Its name is a reference to its pervasive slippery scent. Can you name our mystery plant? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag. You'll also snag a pack of the card game Kumulaau from our friends at Trees for Honolulu's Future.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
Today, the moon and Venus will share a rare daytime dance. The second planet from the sunset will be eclipsed by our moon in broad daylight. Here with more to see in our skies this month is Roy Gal with the University of Hawaii Institute for Astronomy. He spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender for Hawaii Skies.
I'd usually ask you about what's in the night sky, but you have something to share that will be in the daytime sky this month, right?
That's right. And for all your listeners, stars are up at the daytime too. You just can't see them. But last week, if you looked up the sky, you probably saw at sunset Venus and Jupiter, beautiful together. Now, if you look in the daytime, you'll be able to catch Venus and the moon pretty close to each other. And in the case that any of your listeners on the mainland, and I know you have some, from there, the moon will actually occult or block Venus. So you'll have an eclipse of Venus by the moon in the daytime, which you can see if you have really great eyes or with binoculars. And if you're still interested in Venus, then you can continue following it. And later in the week, it'll be in front of a cluster of stars called the Beehive Cluster, which is kind of like the Pleiades star cluster that a lot of people know. And so you can use Venus as a signpost to find that and grab a pair of binoculars and you'll see the pile of stars behind it.
I like that we're talking celestial mashups this month, pretty much.
That's right. We need to have a new crossover, planets and stars crossover.
I love it. So there's a space mission to an object discovered by telescopes right here in Hawaii, too, that you wanted to share, right?
This is really cool, I think. So we have one of the world's foremost survey telescopes here on Haleakala called Pan-STARRS, which looks for asteroids. And one of the many asteroids they found in 2016, about 100 meters across, and it has a very unusual orbit that sometimes comes close to Earth. Because it's unusual, they took the opportunity to give it a Hawaiian name, working with Imiloa Astronomy Center and Hawaiian language students through a program called Ahua He Inoa. And the asteroid's name is Kamo Oʻalewa, which means the fragment, like it's a broken off from something bigger, and lewa, which means like to go and oscillate or go back and forth. And so we've got it discovered by UH, named by Hawaiian language students here. But the coolest thing, I think, is that China just launched a mission to go to this asteroid, scoop up a piece of it, and bring it back to Earth next year.
Oh, wow. Okay. So we'll keep our eyes on Kamo'olewa then.
That's right. We should know next month if the mission made it to the asteroid successfully.
Fingers crossed. What else can listeners look forward to this summer?
Well, we have a really cool event organized by our friends at a group called Ohana Kilohoku on Hawaii Island. And they're hosting a special Ohana stargazing event at a very sacred and historical Mo'okini Heiau on Hawaii Island. And that'll be July 11th from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. I've been to this event before. It's amazing. It's completely incredible. They combine Hawaiian cultural practices, history, and stargazing. And it's a great location with dark skies. It's very remote. You'll have to take a bumpy dirt road to get there. So folks who are interested in going just need to register online. It's intended to be family friendly, so bring your kupuna, bring your keiki, and Ohana Kilohoku will have information on their website and we'll send you the link for where to register.
You've been there before. What was your favorite part?
Boy, it's hard to explain, but they had the State Historic Preservation Division talking about the history of the Heiau going back hundreds of years, and then cultural practitioners doing the opening ceremony and sharing mo'olelo, and you just feel the power of a location like that. And then to then bring in astronomy and celestial navigation, I thought it really combined all aspects of Hawaii and astronomy and culture in one place, and that was really special.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Roy, for sharing all this great information with listeners.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for hosting me.
That was Roy Gal from the UH Institute for Astronomy. We will have links to find out more on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, for nearly 90 years committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Age and income don't matter when it comes to supporting HPR. Whether you are 23 or 83, you can make a meaningful gift to HPR through your will, trust, or other estate plan. You can even name the station as a beneficiary of a life insurance policy or retirement plan. And when you do, let us know so we can recognize you in our Legacy Society. Learn more and get started at hawaiipublicradio.org/legacy.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. On today's Manu Minute, we've got the song of a little hopping honeycreeper found only on Maui. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Maui aloa hio, or Maui creeper, is a small insectivorous Hawaiian honeycreeper found only on Maui. They range in color from olive green in females to mostly bright yellow in adult males. And, like many birds that eat insects, both sexes have short, straight bills. They were once found across Maui Nui, including Molokai, Lanai, and Kahoolawe, but now live only on the slopes of Haleakala above about 3,000 feet, primarily in ohia forests, but can also be found in non-native forests dominated by pine and eucalyptus. Nowadays, the best place to see aloa hio and hear their warbling song is at Hosmer's Grove at Haleakala National Park and also Polipoli State Park. Aloa hio hop and creep along trunks and branches of trees, constantly flipping over bark and lichen in search of insects and larvae. These tiny 4.5-inch-long birds set up big territories of 2 to 5 acres, and are unusual in the bird world of Hawaii in that the young, year-old birds often stick around to help their parents take care of their babies at the nest instead of trying to breed on their own. This is known as cooperative breeding and can occur when the young can pass more of their genes indirectly to the next generation by helping their parents raise their siblings than they can by trying to have their own babies before they're ready. Latest estimates indicate there may still be about 100,000 of these birds left on East Maui, but this is about a 40% decrease since the 1990s. Like most other honeycreepers, avian malaria transmitted by introduced mosquitoes is the primary cause for this decline. It's been shown that about 3 out of 4 aloa hio will die from just a single mosquito bite. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society. Since 1939, fostering community values that help to protect Hawaii's native birds through educational programs and scientific research. More at hiaudubon.org.
We'd like to take a moment and share some recent feedback that we received. We heard from several of you following our call-in show on the first day of hurricane season. To answer your questions, we reached out to one of our panelists. Dennis Wong is with the University of Hawaii Sea Grant College Program. He's also the lead author for the Homeowner's Handbook to Prepare for Natural Hazards. Here's what a caller from Honolulu had to say.
I wanted to ask, what sort of emergency shelters, if any, do we have available on Oahu, where we speak it with a Category 5 hurricane, but I don't know about Neighbor Island. Is there anything in the works to offer incentives to businesses that may have structures that could serve as shelters to make those available for the community?
You know, we do appreciate your call. And Dennis Wong says, Category 5 storms are rare and not as likely in our area, but in terms of shelter, your best bet is to find a concrete reinforced building like a condominium or workplace. Go there and stay away from windows, especially on the lower floors. The taller and newer the building, the better. This could be a friend or relative's place. As a last resort, go to a public shelter, but this requires advanced planning. As for offering incentives to businesses that could serve as shelters, well, the state is exploring this as part of the Green Fee program. There's also a Good Samaritan law that encourages private building owners to allow the public to shelter during an emergency. And we also received this call from a listener named Bradley.
This is Bradley in Kailua Kona. I discovered something interesting that old carpet put on the windows with the backside of the carpet facing outward. If you staple or nail that up there temporarily, if a branch got taken off in a hurricane and was driven into your window at 60 miles an hour, it's not going to go through the carpet. It's a lot easier than nailing up 3/4 inch plywood, which when they're wet can weigh 60 pounds, whatever, 40 pounds. So carpet works really good for us human beings. Fresh little people, aloha.
Well, Dennis Wong says he's a little bit skeptical of stapling or nailing carpet. Even thinner pieces of plywood are still heavy. But consider other ways to protect your windows. For older houses, he recommends making sure the roof and the walls are tied down or connected. Window protection needs to be worked on before a hurricane watch or warning because it's very hard to do during an incoming system. And impact-resistant windows will always stay in place and can pass the large missile test, but they are expensive to install. For more options, check the homeowner's handbook to prepare for natural hazards. And finally, we received this voicemail on our talkback line from Mark.
This is Mark from Kula and Maui. My understanding is that hurricane insurance does not cover unless it's a named storm. So in other words, it has to be a named hurricane. Tropical storms are not covered. And my experience in 50 years of living in Maui is that the most damage historically has been done by tropical storms.
As for insurance, Wong says each company is different, so you really need to read the fine print. Some companies may cover only hurricanes. Some may cover only named storms, and tropical depressions. For best protection, make sure you have hurricane insurance and other protections in place. These can typically be covered under normal homeowners insurance under windstorms. The key is to shop around for your insurance and read each policy carefully, as each company is different. We do appreciate the feedback. If you have a question or comment to share, leave us a voicemail, 808-792-8217. You can also write to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. A new pocket-sized guide explores the creatures living in rugged rocks and rippling tide pools with special attention paid to native species that you can't find anywhere else. Keoki Stender is a scuba repair technician and marine educator with a passion for underwater photography. He's the author and photographer of A Pocket Guide to Hawaii's Tide Pools and Reefs. He reached out to Mutual Publishing after observing a need for a book like this. Stender spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about his hopes for the Pocket Guide. He grew up fishing with his dad and going to tide pools with his grandmother, but a memorable experience in high school set him on his journey.
The first time I did a scuba dive in the ocean, I was in the back of the group and there were people kicking up the sand in front of me and all these beautiful shells were popping out of the sand. I had my little bag. I'm like, there's a big score. I'm just bagging shells. Like, this is great, man. I think I know what I want to do for the rest of my life. And so that started my interest, and I started to attend the Hawaiian Malacological Society. It's a local shell club, and it's still active today. And I was the youngest one of all because I was just high school. And so all these, you know, 60-year-olds are there. These experts and pioneers in the field of scuba and shell collecting were there. A lot of them are authors. Many of them have passed away now, but there's still a very solid core group of serious shell collectors. But now the club has many younger members, and it's expanded to people who just appreciate shells as jewelry or, you know, just things of beauty and not necessarily for scientific knowledge, but it's a whole wide range of interests. So it's actually evolved into something really, really great.
The shell club meetups, I feel like people would bring cool things from their collections. It'd be a really fun time.
Oh, every meeting we'd see like really rare shells, really common shells, interesting, you know, freak shells, not only from Hawaii, but around the world. And some dealers would come and, you know, show some of their things. And so it's a really cool place to learn about different parts of the world and reefs and oceans. And so it's just it's a really cool scene to get into.
You're also a photographer, and that interest kind of arose after the shells, after the love for the ocean.
Well, I was a university student, and while I was at the Wimmer Community College, we had a training program to teach students how to survey reefs, to do a scientific study, to quantitatively estimate the types of corals that are there, the numbers of fish, etc. So we were learning how to identify species by their scientific names, because that scientific name is universal no matter where you go. So, you know, a lot of it's in Latin or Greek, so you have to know how to spell. And this was back in the time before the internet, time of cell phones, before digital cameras, and so it was all film. So there was a need for a certain species that were missing in our collection. So I took it upon myself to learn how to take pictures by going to the library and reading about everything photography. So I got into it that way, teaching myself, and I started, getting some really nice pictures. And so I was able to convert those pictures into a digital format and create a website to continue my educational work for anybody who is interested in the ocean.
Well, what is it that draws you to it? Is it the idea of capturing everything there is to capture, kind of collecting it all, or something else? Because I feel like you would probably run across some of the same species again and again and want to take photos of them.
Yeah, that's right. So being diving here for 30 years, I've seen a lot of species. And so almost everything I'd see in the ocean, I've seen already. I've got good pictures of it. So more so I look for maybe it's behaviors, or I would travel and see different species. But there's always new things to discover, because like in the world of microshells, there's things that are tiny, they're a quarter inch at adulthood, and you don't see them crawling around because our eyes are, I'm getting older, I don't see them as much as I used to, but there's things that come out at night that you don't get to see that are hiding under the rocks or in the holes. So there's always something new to see if you take the time to really look for them. But yeah, the goal for me was to get at least one good photo of each species that I can get hold of and put them on the website and create a species page for it. So I'm getting to the point where now I have to travel to get new content, or I can rely upon other divers who are finding cool things and they send them to me for identification. I go, oh, that's a new species, or this is a new addition to my website. Can I use your picture and create a new page with this? And of course, they're stoked to have it on the website. So it's a win-win. It's curating other people's work and expanding the website.
Part of having this website and now having this pocket guide is there's an aspect of sharing it with other people so that they can identify what they might be seeing or just appreciate the photography. But why is that important to you, that there be an audience here?
It boils down to when I was a kid, there were books on certain topics. And Hawaii is a very niche market. It's very small, especially back in the 60s and 70s. You know, Hawaii is a very small market. And books that were present were not very many, and they're either very expensive or they're very brief and simple. So there was always a need for a really good guide that included a lot of the species. And there's never going to be one that has everything. And so by having a book that's affordable, like the Tide Pool book and the upcoming Shell book, I'm able to reach many people. There's a great need for that. I get a lot of email requests. What species is this? Do you know what shell this is? I get so many every week. And so I thought, I really got to make a guide. And the books that are on the market right now they're $100 books, $200 books, and there are no cheap books until now. So it's a good time to reach the market with these.
Talk a little bit about the pocket guide that you put together, because listeners can't see it. It truly is a pocket guide. You could take it with you if you're beachcombing or walking along near tide pools.
Okay, so this pocket guide is only 5x7, so it really is a big pocket guide. It goes to the beach. It's not waterproof, but it has really great photography and the colors are really good. It's really well done. Mutual Publishing, they did a great job creating this book. And covers most of the animals and seaweed that you'll see on a low tide reef or on a beach walk. It's good for family. It's good for anybody who has got a sincere interest in the ocean and wants to learn a little bit more than just that's a sea urchin or that's a seaweed. So I spent a lot of time going through the entire list of species that I could see on a reef just by walking there and recording it and boil it down. Okay, what's the most common? What would I see in many areas of Hawaii? And got it down to a decent number. So I think most people would be very satisfied with this book.
It has more than 280 photos of creatures that you'll find in these tide pools, and you took all the photos. What are just some of the stories behind the photos that come to mind, or any particular species you really had to track down for this book?
There's a few. One of the most interesting, I thought, was the hectic auger shell. It's shaped like a cigar. It's a little white shell. It's about 2 or 3 inches long. And they live on the beach slope where the waves go up and down, like Makapu'u or Waimanalo Beach. If you go at night and you shine your light, you might see a wave wash up and then recede back into the water. And you'll see like it's kind of like a little darker patch of water where it might be kind of slimy. And you can dig down and find this auger shell. And what they do is they spend their entire life on that slope. They never are totally submerged. And they take a wave, they surf up, expose and surf up the wave, and they slide back down. And as they slide back down, they're sniffing for worms. And they'll dive into the sand and grab that worm. It's really cool because it's the most unlikely place for a shell to be. And why would it, you know, how can a shell take the abuse of waves, you know, one after another for their entire life? They're really cool. So that's one of my most unique species and hard to find. Another one might be the red pencil urchin. The red pencil urchin, it's bright red, so it's hard to miss when you're tide pooling. And the Hawaiians used to use those for ornaments, or also they had like a red dye in the skin of the spine. So it's kind of interesting. It'll stain your hands if you touch it. But these urchins are very important for the reef because they actually, they gnaw away at the coral rock, the dead coral rock, which is made of seaweed or coralline seaweed, and they grind it away and they create sand. But they also contribute to the erosion of the reef, which is not necessarily a bad thing because you need to erode the rock to create rubble, and the rubble becomes home to many more invertebrates like crabs and shrimp and snails. So it's part of an ecosystem, so it's very useful.
Yeah, each of these just feel like a snapshot into another world.
Yeah, it's amazing because when you learn about one species and you look at maybe the biology, and then you learn that the sea urchin may actually have little parasitic snails that live on its external skeleton, and they'll actually stick their tongue and then embed it into the fleshy parts of the urchin and suck the blood out of it slowly, just a parasite, and they can spend their entire life there. And then these little parasitic snails may actually hold, may contain some bacteria or viruses or worms or other kinds of microbes that need to be in this snail. And the snail gets eaten by a crab or a fish, and then it gets passed through the food web or chain. And it needs each step through each animal to replay its entire life cycle, called intermediate host. But there's so many things that you can learn about, or even just the bacteria that lives on the skin of an animal has an entire ecosystem in there. And the more we're learning about microbiology and molecular biology, there's more stuff people are learning about. It is incredibly interesting to learn that it's so complex and all works together.
And where it starts is seeing an unknown shell or an unknown organism and looking it up in something like a pocket guide and realizing this is a species, it has a name, and using that to spark creativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I created my website and the books as a starting point for, you know, for a curious child or, you know, somebody who's a serious student can just identify it first. And then they can jump off into the internet and look around for papers and you know, all kinds of research about anything that's related to it. So it's very basic, but it's just kind of gets you going.
You teased that there's going to be an upcoming shell book. Tell us more about what we can expect from that.
So the shell book idea came from, well, the pocket guide is too small. It doesn't have enough space to put all the mollusks. And there is a really great reference book for Hawaiian shells done by Allison Kay in 1979 that is black and white photos. It's very technical, very scientific, very dry reading for anybody who is not a scientist. But this book is considered the Bible of Hawaiian shells, and it's out of print. So this book, the new book, is going to be a color illustrated, easy to use guide that illustrates those shells in color and in bigger pictures, and has very brief information about how big it gets, where it lives, its habitat, where it exists, including Hawaii. So maybe it exists in Africa and the Philippines. Includes that information. So it's going to be a really good companion to the original K book. But anybody who has got an interest in shells, from the beachcomber to the family to the jewelry maker to a serious shell collector, can use it to quick and easy, just look at a glance and find that shell.
That was Keoki Stender, and HPR's Maddie Bender. Stender's book is titled A Pocket Guide to Hawaii's Tide Pools and Reefs. It's available online through Mutual Publishing. And Stender shares that the sequel on Hawaii shells will be out this fall. Now it's time to harvest the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about some native plants that smell, for better or worse. Hawaii's white hibiscus is unique for being the only scented hibiscus in the world, and they're known for having quite a pleasant scent. But other plants are more pungent. We asked you to tell us the name of a native plant that some say can be smelled from 200 feet away. The plant's Hawaiian name translates to wandering fragrance and may refer to an octopus because of the slippery way this scent slides down its trees, allowing you to smell this plant long before you can see it. This tree provided strong, durable wood for weapon crafting, while the leaves were used to make black dye for clothes and mats. We've been talking about the bold, citrusy scent of the ahuhe'e. That blossom, ironically, the scent of it tends to diminish when you smell the flowers up close. And our winner today, Uja from Kahala, you got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Okea o nohi keha ike aoku.
You know, this Friday is Juneteenth, celebrating 161 years of freedom for all in the United States. As we mark the holiday, we wanted to take a look back at a project that celebrated African Americans' impact here in the islands. Popolo Heno, Songs of Resilience and Joy, was released in June of last year. It's nominated for the Hawaiian Music Album of the Year. And the album features songs performed by local musicians, including Akalani Pea and Kamaka Kehau Fernandez. It also features a tribute to former President Barack Obama, composed by Patrick Lindeza. The songs highlight the often unseen contributions that Black Americans have made to the islands. The Conversation's Lillian Song spoke with Mahealani Uchiyama, the composer behind the project, back in February of 2025. Take a listen.
So I love history. It's basically an exploration and a celebration of little known stories that I think really should be better known, because it would be to all of our benefit to know these things. And I've been blessed just in my career of, you know, presenting hula and bringing my dancers to Hawaii to perform, and, you know, performing here, and just the people who are, we're in each other's orbit and extended family. It's important that in bringing this to the world, that the music itself be as beautiful and as amazing and as good as possible, which is why I asked a number of my friends and colleagues to be a part of it.
Name some of them for us.
We have 4-time Grammy Award winner Kalani Pea contributed a song. We have composers Kamaka Kehau Fernandez, Kaulike Piskaya, Patrick Landeza, Kumuhula Kavika Alfichi. We have Hawaii's First Lady of Jazz, Azure McCall. We also have other amazing musicians who've contributed as musicians on the project, and they would include Ikaika Blackburn, Danny and Nani Carvalho, Justin Firmeza, Haneleka Anapu and Jerome Koko of the Makaha Sons, Vailao Ryder, and Nathaniel Mahialani Stillman.
Impressive list there, Mahia. What was the aha moment that started the ball rolling on this project?
It was in the back of my mind for a number of years, I must say, at least 7 or 8 years. But it was a conversation with a hula student of mine who was from Hawaii, who was part African American, and they were saying something to the effect of how they were made to feel like they didn't belong there. And they were really happy to have me as their hula teacher. So it wasn't that they said to me, oh, you should do this project, but them expressing to me the sentiment that someone who was born in Hawaii, you know, who was half black, was made to feel like they didn't belong, really hit me personally. So that got me started to thinking that, well, you know, there is a history there that this young person didn't know, and maybe their compatriots, their classmates didn't know. And I certainly didn't know it when I lived in Hawaii. And what difference might that have made, you know, for all of us, had we had some inkling that there was this history there? And really, what's the best way for people to integrate and to appreciate things anywhere, but especially in Hawaii, but through song, through mele, through hula? And is there a way that I can start to bring these stories to life?
And there are three buckets that these songs fall into?
Yes, the first bucket is songs about historical people, people in history. These will include people like Betsy Stockton, who was born an enslaved person, raised as an enslaved child, received her manumission as a young woman, and then joined the mission to go to Lahaina. And while the missionaries were teaching the children of the Ali'i, she focused on teaching the children of the Maka'ainana, the common people. Another person in history is Alice Ball, who created a treatment for Hansen's disease, leprosy. She was also the first woman and first African-descended person to graduate from the College of Hawaii, I believe it was called, that became the University of Hawaii. It's people like John Blossom, who was born a slave in Jamaica and part of a merchant marine ship, got off in Hawaii, and became a member of the court of Kapa'akea and uncle to two children who would become the king and queen of Hawaii, King Kalakaua and Queen Liliuokalani, and actually died as a result of going to Chile to try to free Pacific Islanders who had been enslaved there. A second bucket would be people writing songs about people who are currently here. Examples of that would be Kalani Pe'a wrote a song about his friend Kamaka Kehau Fernandez, which is a beautiful tribute. And my friend Kumukavika wrote a song about me, and it's also included in the program, in the project. And the third bucket would be songs of personal declaration. So Kamaka Kehau contributed a song about his love for his homeland that adopted him as a baby. And also, as you recall, writing about how she feels. Basically, her home extends from Oakland to Hawaii and back again. Those are the three buckets that songs tend to fall into.
You wear a lot of hats: dancer, choreographer, musician, author, teacher, advocate for cultural understanding. You're the founder and artistic director of the Mahea Uchiyama Center for International Dance, Kumuhula of Halau Ka'ua Tuahine of Berkeley, California. And you are also the creator and director of the annual Kapili Polynesian Dance and Music Workshops. You live in California, but it's very apparent that the time you spent in Hawaii has made a very deep impression on you. And so I understand you first came to the islands as a student at the University of Hawaii, but take me back further to that time when you first heard about Hawaii.
That's so interesting. I don't think I could have been more than 6 or 7 as a child in Washington, D.C. And this was right when the civil rights movement was beginning to take hold. And of course, you know, we were the nexus of a lot of the protests and just a lot of the attention given because, you know, first was Kennedy and then Johnson. Anyway, we got the usual magazines in the Black household, the Ebony's and the Jet magazines. And I was an avid reader. And I remember distinctly, it was an Ebony magazine that spoke about the Reverend Martin Luther King's, I believe it was his third march in Selma. And they were wearing, he and several of his supporters next to him were wearing flower garlands. I didn't know that they were leis. All I knew was, wow, this is really cool. I want to wear a flower necklace too. And we had the World Book Encyclopedia, and I just started looking stuff up and asking people, and I finally figured out that this was something that happened in a place called Hawaii. And that was really how I began to be aware of Hawaii, and my fascination with Hawaii, I can say, actually began right then.
And I'm looking at the playlist. There is one of these tracks in here that tips back into your connection with Hawaii way back when you were a 6-year-old.
Yeah, so that image that I described to you, that is a set of very famous pictures of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. wearing a lei along with some of his compatriots, has always intrigued me. And in the process of doing the research for this and encouraged by one of our advisors, Adam Manalo Kelvey Camp, I looked up how this connection came. Apparently, soon after Hawaii became a state, and well before there was time to build a state capitol, the state legislature met in the throne room of the Iolani Palace, and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was invited to come and speak to the Hawaii State Legislature. So that just got me to thinking, you know, how interesting it is that the king was speaking in the throne room of the queen of Hawaii. And so I started to look up the things that he said to the state legislature at that time, and also some of the things that Her Majesty Queen Liliuokalani said to her people during the time of the overthrow. And to me, the sentiments hit very similarly. And so I was inspired to put the two together in a song.
Pursue the path of peace. We've got to see it through to be free. We cannot walk alone. To be free.
It feels very pertinent right now in terms of asking, of calling to us to be unafraid and to be hopeful, and to turn towards one another instead of the division that seems to be overtaking us, to fight against that.
That was Mehealani Uchiyama and HPR's Lillian Song. The album Popoloheno, Songs of Resilience and Joy, is available for streaming on YouTube and Apple Music. It's been nominated for Hawaiian Music Album of the Year at this year's Nahoku Hanuhanu Awards. The winners will be announced next month. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to hear from Hawaii residents who got a chance to preview the Presidential Center ahead of the official opening. They are the fellows from the Obama Leadership Program. Where do they go from here? What are your thoughts about the center? Leave your feedback or email us, here at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find all of our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.